are starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interview Stefan Haves about clowning, his work with Cirque du Soleil, and his new book called The Power of Ha. We start the show with music from Cirque du Soleil, Alegria. But first, a short calendar. At The Wallace in Beverly Hills, thewallace.org, Luminario Ballet of Los Angeles. That's February 17th and 18th. Anthony McGill and the Pacifica Orchestra, that's February 23rd, and Santa Cecilia Orchestra on February 25th. That's just a few of their wonderful events. TheWallace.org for more information. Okay, stay tuned. Music from Alegria, and then Stefan Haves. Mystic Pete here with Stephen Haves, February 3rd, 2023. I featured you on my show a few weeks ago because you're this fabulous production called Shambles at the Ivy Substation in Culver City with the Actors Gang. But today we're going to focus on a book you just came out with called The Power of Ha, H-A.
That is correct, sir.
I read it. I'm very impressed.
Why, thank you.
It's part autobiography, part history of clowning, part what clowns are doing, but mostly teaching. You're explaining to people how to be a clown, what's involved, what are the underlying foundations and principles.
Right. Clowning is such an immersive, kind of ephemeral, stupid practice that you can't really give people, do these five exercises and you'll be a good clown. So I had to include my youth, my failures, my doubts, and then a lot of the heroes that I met along the way, who, when I saw someone who I was completely enamored by, I stalked them and I stood around them and I learned from them. And then the techniques, I didn't even go into depth about what exactly to do in these exercises because I'm more interested in people's interpretation of, if you get the main concept, the main thesis, I want you to design your own exercises the way you would do it. There's a folk tradition with variety. It's different even than magic. I don't care if you did all of my exercises, steal them all. That's great. But for your own sake as an artist, I hope you bend them a little bit so a folk tradition arises and they change with the times, which they have to. Clown and humor has to change with the times.
I think what you're saying refers also to the underlying force of clowning, and it makes it difficult to fake. Of all the arts, it's probably the hardest to fake because the essence of being a clown is, well, it's kind of being the outsider. It's being a voice that questions whatever reality we've all accepted and pokes fun at it. And you have to be in a pretty solid, authentic inner state to do that. You just can't like put on the mask. You have to kind of become it. And you talk about this in the book.
Right. As a clown, vulnerability is your strength. Disclosure of discomfort is your strength. It's counterintuitive to the paternalistic, I'm going to just suck it up and go mentality that I grew up with as a baby boomer. And so ultimately, in clowning, either the audience loves you or hates you in the first 10 seconds. And if you're a clown, they hate you. And you've got to actually convince them in those first 10 seconds that this is a worthy venture, you coming into my world, and let's see what we have to solve.
Well, when I was a kid, the circus that would come through town, this little town I'm in, Los Angeles, regularly was like the Barnum and Bailey's Circus. And I remember it being kind of this awful experience of like loud and obnoxious and animals that seemed very unhappy. And the clown part, it was kind of like goofy clowns with fire extinguishers or just kind of being stupid. And then along comes Cirque du Soleil. And it's just this whole, like, we're going like, what is this? It's suddenly this kind of tender, artistic, magical thing, no animals. So I think the concept of clowning, or what was a professional clown, I bring up a lot of issues here. We can go into any one of these. Like what was considered a professional clown 50 years ago as opposed to right now, and then how clowning has shifted from this just kind of like obnoxious entertainment form to something very subtle, particularly through Cirque du Soleil. And a lot of troupes that emerged out of the 60s, they were kind of homespun and goofy and sweet and mercurial. Anyway, just talking about where things were when we were kids to where they are now.
Also, you have to look at it geographically. I mean, we're talking Cirque du Soleil didn't come up with this art form, but they did immortalize it and make it global. This art form was actually happening in Europe, in small circuses all around Europe. And America was not one big top, but three, like a multi-big top. And I remember exactly what you were probably going through. The only thing I remember from Ringling Brothers is the smell of the elephant poop.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all I really remember. But I can tell you Ringling Brothers, because I have friends who are probably vaulted to some of the greatest comedians in the world, and others are still working today. But Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey, you were on a train, and your job was basically, how do you set up in the circus, how do you set up a trapeze? You got to set up this huge net. We got about 2.5-3 minutes that we have to just cover that. So that became the clown's job. And so they didn't pay them much, and all they had to do was smoke and mirrors for about 2 or 3 minutes.
Just so be goofy.
So the real ones would come on.
Yeah.
Now, just be goofy is a funny concept. What does that mean to be goofy? They were goofy because there was no empathy for them. You didn't empathize with the clown. Sometimes the lead clown, you would. Even in Ringling Brothers, when there was a clown act, oh, this guy can't cook something and they're getting into a fight. But ultimately, you had young people who did punchlines without setups because they weren't in the limelight. They were just there basically to distract you while the real acts were setting up.
Interesting. And there was a clown makeup. There was a look. It was like big balloony clothes. Or big floppy feet. Yeah, there was that look, that's the clown, but Cirque did,
there is
a whole other thing going on.
There is an Americana tradition, and I never resonated with that. In fact, it repelled me a bit. So,
me too.
So part of my mandate is to actually bring clowning into the fold of into the world, into the fold of humans as a necessary archetype in life. But it's got to be someone who I care about. And so if my job to work with clowns is more the setup than the punchline, Ringling Brothers was more into the punchline. They wanted to get to the fall, get to the pie in the face. And so actually Ringling clowns are some of my most challenging students because they want to get to the punchline. And I we may not even get to the punchline, dude. They don't like you yet. So I have to get them to like you. The makeup worked probably at a certain time. Everything's cyclical. So at some point it resonated with a lot of audiences. But as we go forward, Cirque was the one that went minimal with the makeup. At first, it wasn't totally minimal because they were following the Russian. Basically, when you cast Cirque du Soleil, there are the Russian clowns, which are like Slava Snosha, which are very, very expressionistic and white and big nose and all that kind of stuff. And then there was European, which was a little more subtle. But then when I went and worked with Cirque du Soleil alongside David Shiner, who was the director, we actually started a new category of clowns, which were the North American clowns who could speak, who didn't have big makeup, just a bit of white on the face. But the big deal is they could speak and they could do verbal humor too. But our background was knockabout. It was rougher. It was like a slapstick, cops and robbers.
Or fire extinguishers or something like that.
But it's how you do it. That's the interesting thing about all this. I once had a guy say to me, very, very talented guy, very talented client. He's like, you know, Stefan, I like your work, but it's a little cliche. And I said, thank you. That's the best compliment you could give me, because I want everyone to not question the why. I want them to know there's the little schmuck, there's the bigger ballsy guy, and now how we bend the cliche, how we alter the cliche, how we modernize the cliche, that's my job.
This is a little off topic, but because I have this clown historian before me, let me just ask you about this old style understanding of clowning and circuses, the carny culture and even carny language. And could you just talk about that? Just, I'm interested because it shows up in a lot of movies as this kind of gothic, absurdist, little clicky thing that's at the same time scary but also exciting.
There are many kinds of ways to approach clowning. I think we were all perfect clowns before puberty. And so mine is I'm the fool. I want the audience to feel that they are guileless, that they're naive. The child is alive in all of us, asleep in some of us, but alive. And I'm not here to teach anything. I'm here to let you remember what you were like when you were awesome with your friends, you didn't judge yourself, and your job was to play. When you were 6 or 7, it's like, hey, Mom, I'm going into my room. I got to play. I mean, that was like your job for a few years. And so then we get into puberty, middle school, and everything goes to kaput in terms of your creativity because your body's changing. You want to fit in. You don't want to be in the spotlight, because if you're in the spotlight, you will get judged. You will get traumatized, because middle school is all about trauma. You know, it's like and enduring it and surviving it. Then after that, you go into high school, and this is where the sideshow comes in. This was my roundabout way. The sideshow is uniquely adolescent in its nature. Let's touch tongues. Let's pierce ourselves. Let's do this. Oh man, we are so cool, and we're gonna do everything. So
the strong man, the hairy woman, but this is its parallel. And I got it. Okay.
Right, and after like high school, we want to do mosh pit. We wanna be a punk. We wanna rebel. We don't really know what we're rebelling against, but we know anything that's not me is boring. Okay,
gotcha.
So the sideshow kind of goes to that place of when you're ready to individuate away from your family and you want to run away to the sideshow. Now, sideshow people aren't particularly safe. I wouldn't call it a safe container. It's a different kind of adrenaline than just being on stage. It's like watching a car wreck. You have to look at it and you have to watch it. But ultimately, if my mandate is empathy and kindness and those things, that's kind of the opposite. This is like, hey, let's go see that person. And then we can be separate from that person as we feel like elites talking about how weird the bearded woman was. So it kind of separates us to those people outside of the community. But me, I paid my money. I'm fine. And that is, but you can live in that place for a while.
So I think something you do is you get people thinking a lot, and a lot of like hidden material comes out. And as you're talking, I'm going like, oh, isn't our society right now, like the whole society, because we're so lost, it's all sideshow. It's just like the Duggar family and Honey Boo Boo. Like, we want to go into these really bizarre little quadrants of entertainment and really extreme sports and all this, because we're so lost. We're like, we're an adolescent culture. We want to like explore the edges of our consciousness through the arts. Like, but everything, even politically, it's just so edgelord. Mm-hmm. And anyway.
Think of it like there was Greece, and then there was the fall of Rome. What happened during the fall of Rome? You had lions eating people in, like, you know what I mean? It's like when society has lost its moral, like, moorings, you go to extreme, because gosh forbid you think about yourself and the lens is not on you. The lens is, oh, this is so weird out there, as opposed to, wow, my relationships aren't great. I've got to change me. I've got to make me better right now, you know, as opposed to constantly being barraged by the external stimulus that gets more and more perverse.
And teenagers, and I guess society, finds what they are by putting on these different hats. Sometimes they're crazy.
But the truth of the matter is, and this is going, if we go into another direction, because I was just teaching at Cal Arts, and I'm talking to 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I'm a baby boomer, and the way they are rebelling is they're saying, you were too permissive. You didn't treat people kindly. Your favorite comedians disparaged through imitation, black people, Latinos. My favorite all-time comedy movie, The Party with Peter Sellers.
Which I mentioned
in the book. He plays a man from India. But the comedy that Peter Sellers does is huge. So can the 20-year-old forgive the cultural approbation or just doing something wrong, or it's wrong? Like, and I said to them, I posed to the kids today, I'm like, okay, you guys have pretty much canceled Woody Allen, you know? So Woody Allen's early movies, if you look at Take the Money and Run,
Bananas, Sex.
Right. All of these kind of movies before he got into his more like, dabbling with relationships.
Manhattan and all those.
The early ones were kind of this kind of just silly fun, right? But we have canceled him totally. So when I even brought Woody Allen up, I saw one of the students wince. She kind of winced. She was like, ooh. Mm. And I'm like, okay, so let me get this straight. We cancel Woody Allen because it's in our lifetime. However, if you look at Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, Fatty Arbuckle, if you look at the early classics, they are brilliant. And if you put their lives under a microscope, they would just be as sullied as Woody Allen would today. So, but it was a different time with different values and morals. But it's just an interesting topic, I think, that if you screw up now, you're canceled. But if you screwed up back in the 1940s or 50s, we're going to keep looking at your movies and pretend that it's okay. So where does your private life end, and where does your public art live forever? I don't know.
This is a whole other topic we could spend a lot of time on, which I would love. Because, I mean, not only in the arts, but even like Gandhi, people are questioning some of his practices. Like he would sleep with children to show how ascetic he was. But people are going, well, this is totally inappropriate.
Right.
Gandhi. Or, Shakespeare, he wrote The Merchant of Venice. When I saw it, I went, this is profoundly anti-Semitic. Or The Taming of the Shrew. Like
Juliet was 14.
Yeah, right. And Zeffirelli is now in trouble because, well, that's...
Yes, that's all.
But this is the question of the artist and what's appropriate and history. And we look... I mean, it's a complicated question with no easy answers. Should we just write off Shakespeare because he wrote things that were misogynist and anti-Semitic?
Right. And underage...
and racist, yes.
Yeah, underage sex.
I don't know. But
leaving that topic alone.
I do know we shouldn't.
Oh, okay. Okay. Oh. We have an authority who's yes. given us an answer. Maybe yes. we should continue to read the works of Gandhi too, then.
Yes, I believe okay. that. okay. I believe that the pendulum has swung so far to the other side that it does need to go to the middle. And when you get to the middle, part of that kindness and grace is going to be for people who did things when, you know, Don Rickles wouldn't work today. But
yeah.
But Don Rickles, his comedy was healing to our culture.
Yeah, and he would not work at all because it was so, what would you consider racist?
And Robin Williams wouldn't either, because he used dialects of other
true.
Races, and he always referred to his package down below. So,
and I know Jewish people who won't listen to Beethoven. Or Wagner. Wagner was anti-Semitic long before Adolf Hitler, but Hitler used Wagner's music. So, you know, yeah. it's... and they won't... I know Jews who won't listen to Beethoven, won't play Beethoven at official events or something because he was German. I don't know. But Beethoven was a full-on rebel, mm-hmm. you know, in his time. He would have been one of us kind of counterculture people.
Right. But the truth of the matter is, you know, the Dark Ages that happened before the Renaissance lasted for a few hundred years. And we are going into the Dark Ages, but it's not the older people who are actually... making moral rules. It's the young folks too. So there's like a moral high ground with the younger folks, and it will come from below, that like that feeling of separating and appropriate. Even the A word wasn't anything 10 years ago being appropriate. Now, that being said, I must be a bridge for this because these are my children. This is my children's age. So I am part of this problem of the world that they're coming into, which was patriarchal and not really kind and hard in terms of race and you know, inequality of wealth. And I am sorry, and I really need to help them through this. With my wisdom, I can't slough them off. And I can't say it's their problem, sort it out. We weren't entitled like that. No, that's not true. You know, this is a cruel, hard society we live in. And we got to do everything we can for the young artists to be able to articulate how to get us out of this.
Well, coming back to my original thesis for this interview, which was you can't fake it as a clown. Mm-hmm. Like, you got to find your thing. And back to also that you provoke these personal revelations when you just seem to be around other people. I'm remembering in this time of life when I was in school, and having to sit in classrooms for hours and hours every day, and how extremely difficult that was for me. And now, as in my 60s, in my yoga practice, having to go and unwind sitting in class when I was 10 years old, like that's still in my body.
Right.
That contraction is in my body for
right.
decades later. Also, my dad's voice saying, "Stop fooling around, Peter. You're like, stop playing. Like,
right.
behave." And I was just like a goofy, you know, mystic, artsy kid. And this is constant, but both physical and emotional compression on me for years and years and years. And then, of course, as you pointed out, the catastrophe of puberty happened to me, which I'm just about through sorting out now at 63.
Yeah, that's how long it takes for me, too. Yeah.
So now, like, coming into, I think that's a preamble to your book here, like... We come out of these compressed structures. How we find them after we get through the sideshow adolescent part of our, let's talk about that authentic voice and how that emerges, or how you do that with your classes and productions.
The key to this human existence is actually being able to start being the watcher in your life. We have certain cycles that we go through, okay? And as a clown practitioner, or I've been called a clown whisperer, clown wrangler, my job is to anchor folks who actually have been more in the astral zone because of their trauma. So they choose storytelling, theater, and clown. Why do you choose clown? The one thing we all in clowning have in common is problems with authority. We do not trust authority figures. If we trusted authority figures, we would be doing theater, because that because that has a director, a patriarch that is very established for thousands of years, and I have to be a good dog. I have to do the scene. I have to memorize the scene. I have to do the blocking, and I've got to work within this structure of theater. A clown is somebody who fails through not trusting. I never had a mentor in my life. I'm adopted. My mother was a Holocaust survivor. My father died when I was 9. I didn't trust, and no men magically came into my world and said, "Hey, I'm going to help you to excel." I didn't have that. So what happens when you're traumatized that much as between the ages of 7 and 9, you start to pick up compulsions or medicine or practices which aren't necessarily good for you. And part of it is demonizing others, like the victim triangle. It's like, I'm either the prey, predator, or rescuer, but there's nobody who's my equal. So if I walk into a class, he's the predator and I'm prey, okay? And then if I see my twin sister at home, I might be the predator to her and she might be the prey. So it's all not good for me. So for decades, I'm kind of piggybacking off of what you said about it's taken me till my 60s to get over the middle school stuff. And
yeah.
And it's taken me, it was actually in my 50s where I just said, I am tired of this Groundhog Day, going into the same kind of relationships with women, ruining them. What, I gotta stop this. So there comes a point where and so if you walk into my clown class and I ask you to breathe, or I ask you to put your hand out, and I ask you what's in your hand, and you look at your hand and you say nothing, that tells me that you, even though you're saying you're an actor, you're a clown, your imagination is not firing. You are not taking a moment to actually tell a story. So adrenaline, which is our plague, and it's also our heroine if you're a performer, it's good for you because you're obsessed by it, but it's bad for you because it impedes your body, voice, speech, and imagination. So when somebody comes into my class, my job is to be a mentor who anchors you on Earth. Because if you can't look at me and actually have a conversation when the adrenaline is pumping that much, you're dissociated. I can look at someone, I can point to them and say, wait 3 seconds, say my name, go, say your name, go. And they say their name immediately because the adrenaline makes it so they can't follow directions. So how do you...
Oh, I see.
How do you deal... So anybody that walks into a clown class hates authority. That tells me that they've had as much trauma as I have. I'm in the trenches with them. I'm not here to fix them. I'm here to collectively all remember when we were perfect with our friends at 7 years old, away from our parents, when we could sing, dance, play, imagine over and over again.
good response. And you talk about that a lot in your book, The Power of Ha, H-A. I'm speaking with Stefan Haves, S-T-E-F-A-N-H-A-V-E-S, like raves. All right.
Or behaves.
Oh.
But we don't want to.
Oh, we don't. So let's step back a bit and talk more about the archetype you're dealing with. So the clown, and we talked about this earlier, is essentially something outside of society, challenging to structures and organizations and authority. And it shows up particularly in healthy cultures and religions. Like the Native Americans have something called Hayoki or Kachare. There's Loki, Norse mythology. Right. Even in Christianity, there's something called like, the Fools for Christ, or this idea of divine madness. This has been a part of society and religion. When it's healthy, when there's somebody outside of it that can poke fun and take down these awful structures that assemble with power and money, something that can say, it's the jester making fun of the king, and he's the only one who can do it without getting killed. He may get killed too. But this is an archetype in consciousness that I think spells health. Spells health for the individual, the audience, and culture in general.
Yes, absolutely. And I would ask you, I would say, what why do you think, why did theater begin? Like, let's go way back. Let's go to cavemen. Why do you think, what was the first need for the clown?
Go ahead.
The first need for the clown would be, first of all, let's go for the first need for theater or storytelling, as it were. Okay? It all had to do with lack, no rain. No crops. What are we going to do? So when a culture is faced with so many question marks and no answers, the storyteller comes in and says, well, if we all do this rain dance, I heard that in this village 300 miles away, they did this or something like that. So the clown brings in, or the theater brings in, spirit, hope, faith, when the evidence is not there.
Creative thought.
Yes.
New answers.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Got it.
Right. So the clown is in society. Society may be crazy. I had a person say to me, "Oh, I've got to take your clown class because I got to be silly again." I go, I got to be goofy again. I go, excuse me, you know what's silly and goofy? Is people who don't express fully, who can't, you are not silly when your body is firing on all cylinders. You are silly and goofy when you censor yourself, when you get sick, when you get polyps because you can't be angry and express it. But as a clown, you can express every emotion in a safe space. And when you do that, that catharsis is healing for the audience.
So the clown or the actor on stage is often expressing things that the individual can't.
Exactly. And that's why you pay the big bucks.
They're crying, and then maybe you're crying and releasing some of that sadness inside you couldn't access.
Right.
So they're a shaman now.
Absolutely, yes. They're a healing capacity in every culture. And they call out the truth. They are truth tellers, but not in an angry way, but through laughter, which is the way that everybody can acknowledge it without, you know, some of the best comedy ever done was behind the Iron Curtain, where they were the most they were cultures where censors looked at everything, and so, you know, books like Animal Farm, which seemed like it was just a bunch of animals, but you had to be really smart to get, you had to be the clown that was really smart to write the plays to get those radical ideas through.
So it has to be cloaked in certain circumstances. And now it's back on us, the artists. Okay, this is the situation. You're in a dictatorship. You have to still do your art. You don't want to get arrested and killed. Now do it. Put it in a form that children can read, but you're really being radical and challenging authority.
Right.
And I think you find this now culturally. The first thing dictators do is they, you know, kill off any opponents, and mainly artists and thinkers who challenge them. Mm-hmm. So they cannot stand people making fun of them.
Right.
And if you're making fun of the dictator, you will be annihilated.
Mm-hmm.
But then what happens is these dictatorships become very brittle and corrupt because nobody's speaking truth to the boss. So it ultimately, even if, you know, they get the trains running on time for a minute, it becomes very precarious, and it can't withstand any kind of real challenge. So cultures that have this outside for that allow for being made fun of are much healthier. Or religions, look at these awful extremist religions. You do not make fun of us. You obey. You do what you're told. Well, yeah, but they're crawling with pedophiles now and like these horrible religions that you cannot make fun of. You have to accept and follow directions.
Right. I taught comedy in China. It's in the book.
And, yeah, right, right.
I go to China and I have to see what makes something funny for them. So I start out with your typical universal slip on a banana peel, some kind of slapstick. Well, the Chinese were, they thought someone was hurt. And also, they don't want to lose dignity. They want to save face, they call it. So that didn't work. But what did work was corruption. So I did a thing where it took place in a restaurant where the boss was ripping off the waiters while the waiters are stealing silverware. And that was funny to the Chinese audience.
So the petty tyrant. You can't make fun of the top guy, but the mid-level guy.
Exactly. They love that.
Got it. Right.
Yeah.
So, yes, you are the artist. You're the teacher now. You have to find a way to translate, to make this wild world accessible.
Right. Like, what makes you laugh? Corruption made them laugh.
Yeah.
But mid-level corruption. Like, yes. You said, I didn't talk about the president. I didn't talk about... It was not satire. You know, it was more like farce.
Right, right. And by the way, I loved your show called Shambles. I saw it twice. It was with the Actors Gang and Tim Robbins. And there was a lot of very special things happening on top of being a delightful, magical evening that just took us to a different place and a place I really like. But you also, it was a family show, but it was also actually sexually fluid. And like, how do you put those two together? Well, because you're a good artist and you can. There was a person in a wheelchair who was one of the stars of the show,
mm-hmm,
on stage a lot. A person with a disability was starring in the show. Okay, how did you do that? But it worked. It was endearing, and we loved it.
Mm-hmm. My job, my mandate, my passion is because, first of all, I can honestly say I hate theater. I hate going to the theater. I hate when intermission happens, and I don't want to go back in. Yeah. And that's a bigger percentage of time. I think only War Horse was the one that I said, wow, great, I want to know what happens. But then I didn't even like the second act that much. So I'm pretty ADHD. I'm like an 8-year-old going to the theater. I generally don't want to sit for 2 hours. The new generation is more my I resonate with what people need today. So, you know, I did my thesis of the show was a two-pronged approach. Number one, immersive. People don't want to sit and watch people on stage for 2 hours. They want to be part of it. They want to do selfies for themselves in it. They want to take selfies with the performers. I see theater as a holographic experience, not a linear experience anymore. So they multitask to the point of, I'm going to tell a story, not beginning, middle, and end, but beginning, middle, boom, song. What was that? He's there. Behind me is this person. So I want to do a show where a kid's not going to go to their video game on their phone. Okay, so I got to be better. They can't swipe left or swipe right or whatever on my show. My show is going to impact them as quick as their brain wants to multitask. Because that's just absolutely true. So immersive was one of my mandates to get kids in the show, kids in the theater. And that's kids from ages, you know, 7 to 25, you know. And the second one was I had to make it gender fluid. Now, I personally, that's not a personal passion of mine, but anytime I bring up anything like that with students of mine in 18 to 25, they perk up. They're enjoying the concept of that. And I learned so much by making all the women 1962 NASA scientists and all the men, their madmen wives dressed up in drag. Right. So I had drag kings and drag queens.
Yep.
And then I had one of the drag kings turn into a hot alien while the other drag kings were going after her in a very sexual way. But it was women making fun of men doing it. So misogyny had nothing to do with it. Now I'm watching a Bugs Bunny cartoon with people of playing gender fluid. And the kids go, oh, thank God you aren't talking down to me. Mm. And I had one person come in because I called it a panto. And she goes, this isn't a panto. And a panto is an old school, it's not a panto because I didn't take some trope, some old story like Hansel and Gretel. I've done Hansel and Regretel, but that was fun. But I didn't take a story that we know and just parody it linear. That wasn't interesting to me because the new generation doesn't care.
Yeah.
The new generation needs to have these little nuggets that are about 2 minutes long that totally make them happy, and then let's move on.
Well, it's the difference between traditional theater versus linear or one central node radiating out to what I guess they call rhizomatic philosophy, where there's a lot of nodes and it's holographic.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
That's, I guess, what you have to do now.
That's what I choose to do. Nobody has to do anything.
Yeah, but to hold an audience when they have cell phones and so forth.
The blue hairs, I'm technically a blue hair right now. Okay. The older people, the subscription folks, the older boomers they're dying. They're not here. So you better look you better look at the youngsters. And when I look at the kids that I teach, I'm like, you guys have a lot to get people into the theater. It is going to be a big task to reframe what public assembly is all about.
If for no other reason than there's 1,000 other options for that evening.
And it's all at home and it's all in your phone.
Yeah. Why
should you get the hell out of your house?
It's a challenging time to get people to pay to come and sit in a seat. But as far as I can see, you were filling that theater every show.
We did really well.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
What's ahead for Stephen Haves?
Stephen Haves, let me talk to him. let me see. My next big thing is I'm going to Guam. And I'm going to be doing in a 500 seat house. I'm joining a Cirque du Soleil caliber team. It's not a Cirque du Soleil project, but since Cirque du Soleil is not doing a lot of research development, new shows, you have all these brilliant people who've done a bunch of Cirque shows who now are being hired by millionaires in weird countries who own all the theaters and the hotels and everything like that. And so
for weddings or this, right?
No, they own the entire beachfront.
I get it.
So they don't know what to do with their theater. So they invest money, bring in a really good team. And so hopefully that's the next thing I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be part of that team, and I'm going to be doing clowns and characters and storyline while the regular director has her hands full with choreography, lights, and sound.
Sounds exciting. Well, you're in your second edition now of The Power of Ha, H-A. This is your book on clown. Forward by Joan Baez. Look at that. I enjoyed it immensely, and I'm really glad you came to studio today. I would say if there's a central archetype to me, it's the clown. You can maybe tell by the hats with the little ears I often wear. And, I'll tell you something. If I see a woman with a big red nose and floppy feet, I get very aroused. So.
Yeah, because floppy feet, not shoes. I know, big floppy feet arouses you.
There you go. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much.
There will be a show tonight on trampoline. The Hendersons will all be there. Later Pablo Bank is there. What a scene. Over men and horses, hoops and garters. Lastly through a hogshead of real fire. In this way Mr. K will challenge the world. Celebrated Mr. K performs his feat on Saturday at Bishop's Gate. The Hendersons will dance and sing as Mr. Kite flies through the ring. Don't be late. Mrs. K and H assure the public their production will be second to none. And of course Henry the Horse dances the waltz. Sound. And Mr. H will demonstrate 10 somersets he'll undertake on solid ground. There've been some days in preparation, a splendid time is guaranteed for all. And tonight Mr. Kite is topping the bill. We'll be right back.
We are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. So the last tune we heard was called Entrance of the Gladiators by Julius Fujić. This was written in 1897. He was a Czech composer of military marches, popular in his day. And this tune started to be used by circuses in the early 1920s as a screamer march, a tune that got the audience all excited. I'm guessing that my guest today, Stefan Haves, has not used Entrance of the Gladiators to introduce his clowns. Well, it's just so cliche. But I found a recording from the 1920s by Red Nichols and his Five Pennies, and I thought that kitsch could counter cliche. Before that, a tune from a little band out of Liverpool called Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite. We started the show with a song from Cirque du Soleil called Alegria, and you can find The Power of Ha, Stefan Haves' book, easily online. His name is spelled Stefan Haves. Thank you so much for listening today. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out.